Again, my name is Ty Ketchum, and I'm here on behalf of Kansas City Public Schools. I'm not exactly sure which point on appeal this court took interest in. I'm happy to go directly to that if you like. But otherwise, I'll start with the points that relate to submissibility. And first of all, whether or not Mr. Newsom made a submissible case with respect to his wrongful discharge claim. It's the school district's position that he did not, because he was unable to prove that he had refused to engage in an illegal act or an act of serious misconduct, and that he refused or that he failed to prove that he had blown the whistle with respect to conduct that would be illegal, serious misconduct, or not authorized by the law. And with respect to that particular issue, there were two categories of evidence that were submitted to the jury. One related to the Ron Epps contract, the other related to the purchase of Ford Escapes rather than Ford Explorers. With respect to the Ron Epps situation, it's the school district's position that Mr. Newsom did not refuse to engage in any illegal conduct, because when that requisition came to him, he asked his boss, Rebecca Lee Gwynn, the chief financial officer of the school district, what she thought about it, and she told him that he should not approve it, and he didn't. And that's all the evidence we have with respect to that. So his boss actually told him he didn't need to do it. The evidence is that he did not refuse to engage in any illegal conduct. With respect to the Ford Escapes situation, the school district had initially approved, the school board had approved the purchase of Ford Explorers. The school district later learned that they were unable to get the Explorers because they were not available, so they decided to purchase Escapes instead. Mr. Newsom's testimony in the transcript at pages 620 through 626, I believe, sets forth the facts pretty well with respect to what happened in this regard. Mr. Newsom did not blow the whistle. That's the point that the school district wants to make. He was involved when the requisition came in to purchase Escapes rather than Explorers. He was involved in a discussion about how to make that happen, whether the requisition in its current form would accomplish that. Mr. Newsom was of the opinion that it would not, that the requisition should not be approved. This court in the Margiotta case held that merely disagreeing with a company's legally allowed policy does not provide an individual with whistleblower protection. In this particular situation, all Mr. Newsom was doing was expressing his opinion. No one had engaged in any misconduct. They were talking about how do we buy Escapes instead of Explorers. When this conversation is happening, Rebecca Lee Gwynn comes in, the chief financial officer, Mr. Newsom's boss. She says, what are y'all talking about? They tell her. She says, no, we're not going to buy Escapes. Shortly thereafter, she comes back. They're still meeting. And she says, actually, yes, let's go ahead and purchase the Escapes. After that, Mr. Newsom does not tell anyone about anything. He doesn't do anything. He simply processes the requisition.
Did he submit a memorandum objecting to the purchase with the processing?
He, Trial Exhibit 35, Your Honor, along with the documentation related to the processing of the requisition, he attached a memo on the computer system that expressed his disagreement with respect to the manner in which the Escapes were being purchased. But there is no evidence that anyone actually saw that.
Isn't there some evidence, and of course it's up to the jury what to believe, that but plaintiff presented evidence that he was fired because of his objections to the Epps contract and to the purchase of the Escapes. And if I understand your argument correctly, is that if he objects successfully and prevents illegality, then it's not whistleblowing and he has no claim, even if he's fired for doing that. And I don't know of any case that holds that.
Well, what I'm saying, Your Honor, at least with respect to the Ron Epps situation, there is no illegal conduct at the point where
But the point is, he objected it would be illegal to extend the contract beyond the four times that were permitted by the contracting law, and thus therefore wasn't done because they called it to their attention. But he came to the attention of the head of the schools, who was upset that he had interfered with their attempt to procure further work by Mr. Epps. So that he was successful in preventing illegality, if that's true, and it might not be true, was a reason for his firing. Isn't that exactly what a whistleblowing statute is supposed to protect? A whistleblowing policy is supposed to protect?
Well, Your Honor, the whistleblowing policy is supposed to protect people who refuse to engage in illegal conduct.
Or who whistleblow about proposed illegal conduct. You're saying they
True.
Have to wait till the illegality occurs or it's not whistleblowing. Your argument taken in full, that's the result you would reach. You're saying because they ended up not extending the contract illegally, he's got nothing to complain about. But that would mean you have to wait till the illegality occurs and then whistleblow that, as opposed to whistleblowing the attempt to commit something illegal.
Well, the evidence with respect to why Mr. Newsom was fired was that Mr. Covington or Dr. Covington determined that Mr. Newsom, he had spoken to Mr. Newsom about procurement issues in the past. And there was evidence in the case about how there wasn't good customer service being provided with respect to the procurement process.
I'm confident there was evidence on both sides, but plaintiff's evidence was that he was talking about this.
Right.
And why wasn't that a submissible issue?
Well, they submitted it sounds to me like you're focused on the Ron Epps situation. They submitted their claim to the jury with respect to that Ron Epps situation. Their theory was he refused to engage in illegal conduct.
He was told to extend this contract that was contrary, he said, to the purchasing regulations under which he had to operate, and he refused to do that, and they said, oh, you're right, and they didn't do it.
I respectfully disagree.
Under the plaintiff's evidence.
Well, even under the plaintiff's evidence, even if you give the plaintiff you view all of the evidence in the light most favorable to him, the evidence was a requisition simply comes in. There's no illegal conduct at that point in time, and I understand your point about preventing illegal conduct. But the evidence was he then has a question about it, and he takes it to his boss, and he says, what do you think about this? And she says, don't do it. That's what the evidence is. And what we're talking about here is a cause of action that is an exception to the at-will employment doctrine, which is also public policy in the state of Missouri. And this exception is very narrowly drawn according to this court. So if we view it through that lens and we look at the evidence, even in the light most favorable to Mr. Newsom, all he did was ask a question about a requisition. What do you think, boss? Should we do it? Boss says no. Boss doesn't get fired. And so I don't think under those circumstances this court should hold that a submissible case should be made with respect to this very narrowly drawn exception to the at-will employment doctrine.
You're running short on time. Would you discuss the sovereign immunity issues?
Yes, Your Honor. We have two arguments in that regard. The first relates to whether a submissible case was made. It's our position that if you look at the undisputed facts with respect to when the claim here was made, this was a claims-made policy, and so the manner in which we determine when a claim was made is based upon the language set forth in the policy, the definition of claim. The language used to define claim in this policy is unambiguous. A claim is defined as a written demand for monetary relief or an administrative proceeding for monetary relief commenced by the receipt or filing of a charge of discrimination. The claim in this case was made when the notice of charge of discrimination was received or filed. And those dates are not in dispute. On November 18, 2011, the notice of charge of discrimination was filed by the Missouri Commission on Human Rights. The school district received it on November 22, 2011. We have a sovereign immunity non-waiver endorsement on our policy. The question is, did the claim come in before the non-waiver endorsement was put on the policy? If you look at the non-waiver endorsement, it's endorsement number 13. The process date on the endorsement is November 11, 2011. It has an effective date of July 1, 2011.
And is it legal? Are there any cases that say that you can make a waiver, non-waiver, retroactively effective? If the claim came in the middle, could you cut out its legs by retroactively adopting this sort of insurance waiver?
There are no. I was unable to find a case that specifically addressed that point, Your Honor. But I would note that this is a contract between the school district and the insurance company, and we get to dictate what the terms of that policy are.
But you're trying to make, I mean, you have two arguments. One is that it's retroactively effective. The other is that you didn't get notice or claim prior to the effective date if it wasn't effective until November.
I think that's true. But the second argument that you just pointed out, I think that's determinative. So
Can you go ahead and explain that?
Yes. So if you look at the timeline, which again is not in dispute, so this is a de novo review for this court. We have email correspondence that's in the record on November 9, 2011, where we agree to the language with the insurance company about what the non-waiver endorsement will say. And then that is processed, and we actually get the endorsement, and it's dated November 11, 2011. Mr. Newsom filed his charge of discrimination on November 9, 2011. But under our policy, a claim is not made triggering coverage because it's a claims-made policy until the notice of charge of discrimination is either filed or we receive it. There's a distinction between a charge of discrimination and a notice of charge of discrimination. Coverage is triggered based upon the notice of charge of discrimination because that's how we find out about it, and that's how we're then in a position to let the insurer know that a claim has come in. And so if you look at the timeline, November 18th is when the notice of charge of discrimination is filed by the commission, which then triggers notice to us. The endorsement was on the policy on November 11, 2011. And so when the claim came in, the endorsement, the non-waiver of sovereign immunity, which is enforceable in Missouri, was on the policy. That's the first argument we have with respect to sovereign immunity. The second issue relates to whether or not, even if you buy insurance that exceeds $300,000 plus inflation under 537.610, a judgment or settlement can be entered or reached in excess of the $300,000 plus inflation. And it's the school district's position that even if they get by our position that the wrongful discharge claim wasn't submissible, they get by sovereign immunity, that under these circumstances, when a judgment is entered for $500,000 in a common law tort claim against a sovereign entity, remittitor is required because 537.610 plainly states that you're not even allowed to buy insurance exceeding $300,000 for a single occurrence for a common law tort claim.
Thank you. Your time is up. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. First, Your Honors, with respect to submissibility, I'd like to respond to the arguments raised by the appellant. As the court has noted, there were two issues that were presented to the jury here in support of Mr. Newsom's wrongful discharge public policy claim. The first of those was his refusal to approve a payment to Ron Epps, or additional payments to Ron Epps. And the second was his complaints that purchasing Ford Escapes under a given contract were not properly approved by the board, by the school board, and therefore under 432.070, it was illegal to engage in that contract. With respect to the Ron Epps situation, Your Honors, it's very clear in the record that Mr. Newsom objected to making those payments to Mr. Epps. The request came in from the school district superintendent, Dr. Covington, to make additional payments to this to Mr. Epps, who was a leadership consultant from South Carolina. And he had a specific contract that he was engaged to provide services for up to 4 days under his contract, and this was board approved. The circumstances when this request was made was that he had already provided services for several additional days and was billing the school district for in excess of $15,000 additional over what was already approved, what had been in his board approved contract. Mr. Newsom looked at this, he examined the contract, he felt that it wasn't appropriate. He consulted with school district lawyers and then spoke with his superior, Dr. Rebecca Lee Gwynn, the chief financial officer, and expressed that he didn't believe it was appropriate to make this payment to Mr. Epps because the contract had limited it to only four visits. He'd made these additional visits. There was no contractually approved authority to make those payments. She agreed with him, and so that particular payment was not processed. The second...
What was the evidence that figured into his firing?
So with respect to his firing, the position of the school district has been that he was fired for insubordination. And the evidence that came in at trial from Dr. Gwynn was that she was these events that he complained about happened on June 23rd and June 24th, the Thursday and Friday. He was fired the following Monday, June 27th of 2011. Dr. Gwynn's testimony was that Dr. Covington came to her and said, I've had these problems with Mr. Newsom in the past. He's interfering with the processing of payments. He's interfering with our procurement process, and so I'm gonna terminate him. The official position they took in the litigation was that he was fired for insubordination. It's essentially direct evidence that he was fired for these events that he engaged in. So that is really not even in dispute. It's not. There is a variety of pretext analysis that we provided to the jury because they had shifting reasons and shifting statements about who made the decision, when it was made, et cetera. But their official position was he was fired for insubordination, and the evidence that came in from his from the chief financial officer was that Dr. Covington didn't like him interfering with the procurement process. So that's what the evidence was on that, Your Honor.
Counselor, would you please address the issue of the claims made policy? I understand that in the general sense, you know, when you and your client, you know, feel like you had a claim, but is there any case decisions or statutes that would prohibit the school district and their insurance company from entering into a claims made policy that defines what a claim is for purposes of a contract?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, if I'm understanding your question correctly, the contract, the insurance contract, normally defines what a claim is, and it's pursuant to that process or that contractual definition that it's determined whether a claim was made or not. In this circumstance, you know, we have a variety of issues under the insurance contracts that Judge Burnett, the trial judge, analyzed in determining that there had been claims made under the policies. And there are two separate policies at issue in this case, but there was a 2010-11 policy and a 2011-2012 policy. Judge Burnett found that he had made a claim under the 2010-2011 policy, as well as under the 11-12 policy. The endorsement that they're talking about that they attempted to try to add retroactively the sovereign immunity preservation language only applies to the 2011-12 policy. And Judge Burnett found that Mr. Newsom had made his claims under that prior year's policy, and there's no dispute whatsoever that that endorsement did not exist and not apply to that policy. The analysis that she walked through in coming to that conclusion, it required her, you know, we agree and we certainly understand that the interpretation of an insurance contract is de novo. However, there were a variety of factual determinations that the trial judge had to make in order to analyze whether these claims were made and what policy they were made under, and we think that Murphy v. Karen deference is appropriate to the trial judge with respect to those findings that she made about Mr. Newsom's claims and when they were made. So her finding that he made claims under the 2010-11 policy, again, there's no sovereign immunity endorsement preservation there whatsoever. And in order to make those findings that Mr. Newsom had made claims under that policy, she had to review a great deal of factual information, affidavits, dozens of emails, deposition testimony, various settlement-related documents.
Is there any prior case that has said that refusing to sign a release or withdrawing your signature on a release is itself qualifies as a written demand for monetary, non-monetary, or injunctive relief, which is, I think, your first argument?
Yeah, I'm not aware that there's any specific case so holding, Your Honor. But again, we'd point to the language of the insurance policy. It's a written demand for monetary relief. Certainly when Mr. Newsom signed the document, he was asking for a payment of $20,000 and asking...
Well, as they point out, they offered that as if you sign a release, they'll give you a payment, which is fairly common. How was that noticed that he had a particular claim that he for whistleblowing or anything else?
Well, the document itself sets forth the claims that he's releasing. The evidence was that Anthony Moore had described this. The school district's human resources director had described this as a settlement agreement that they were entering into as of that time. And again, the document itself describes that he's giving up all of his claims and potential claims against the school district. Secondarily to that, he then revokes that signature just 3 days later, still within the first policy period. So the revocation in writing of that document is a clear indication as well that his claims that he has previously agreed to accept a payment of $20,000, where he's no longer willing to accept that as payment. So he's clearly going to need greater compensation than he had originally agreed to. So that's the analysis that Judge Burnett walked through in determining that he had made claims under that first policy. Again, let me focus for a minute, though, on the second policy, because there's a lot of issues related to that haven't been fully addressed by the appellant. First of all, we're talking about an endorsement that was clearly not in place at the time the insurance contract was entered into by the school board. And it's clear that insurance contracts, like any other agreement that a school district enters into, have to be in writing, they have to be signed, they have to be board approved. So the contract, the insurance contract that was entered into here by the school district, is subject to the limitations of 432.070. It has to meet those requirements. So they have an endorsement that they are claiming they added to this insurance contract, but it was never approved by the board. There's just some email traffic between counsel for the school district and an insurance broker saying we'd like to add this, which, by the way, happens after Mr. Newsom has filed his EEOC charge, which is defined as a claim under this policy. It says that a claim is any civil, administrative, or regulatory proceeding that is commenced by the receipt or filing of a notice of claim. The EEOC clearly doesn't file anything with itself. It's Mr. Newsom filing his charge with the agency that is the commencement of that claim. He does that on November 9th, well prior to when they tried, 2 days prior to when they, in their best case scenario, have this internal conversation about adding this endorsement after the fact. But again, they don't walk through any of the processes that would be required for a school district to amend this insurance contract. And under 432.070, they have to do that in order for it to be an effective addition to that contract.
They make the argument that if that's true, then they never entered into the insurance contract at all properly because they didn't follow the steps there either.
That's an argument they raised on appeal at the trial court level. They admitted in their answer that they had purchased insurance through these policies that was in effect. So there was never any dispute at the trial court level that the insurance policies were properly entered into, and that was never raised as any, there's no evidence whatsoever of that at the trial court level that they were not properly entered into. In fact, as I said, they admitted it in their answer. So again, what they did with this endorsement was just had internal legal counsel go back and forth with the insurance broker, say we'd like to add this, but it was never put up to the school board. There was no consideration for adding this. And presumably, the school district has purchased coverage that provides coverage for the waiver of sovereign immunity. They paid money for that coverage. That's more expensive coverage than if they were preserving their sovereign immunity waiver. So if they were going to add this endorsement back, theoretically, for there to be appropriate consideration, the school district ought to receive some kind of a refund on its premiums. There's nothing like that. So there's no consideration to add this to the contract, and it's certainly our position that it was never appropriately added and shouldn't be considered even if Mr. Newsom's claims had not occurred before that document, which they did.
Remitter,
yes, sir. Again, on remitter, of course, a very deferential standard to the trial court. It's our view that under this court's decision in the Kunze case, as well as the Court of Appeals decisions in Farm Bureau, Town and Country versus AEIC, that when an insurance contract is entered by a public entity, that affects a complete waiver of sovereign immunity up to the amount of the insurance that's purchased. And so they purchased insurance here up to limits of $3 million for the 2010-11 policy, $2 million for the 11-12 policy. And so it's our position that they waive sovereign immunity up to the limits of that coverage. If not, then effectively what you're be allowing is a school district to engage in this conduct of buying this coverage and then allow the insurance company to get the benefit of receiving payments for those premiums for that full coverage, but not have to provide that coverage to
the district. Well, here we have a statute that says you can't enter into coverage of that amount.
Well, it says pursuant to the language of that particular statute, that's what's permitted. It says notwithstanding any other provisions of law. So, again, the school district did it, whether pursuant to that authority or some other inherent authority, it might have to enter into insurance agreements. And so the policy has been purchased and exists and provides coverage for that full amount. So, consistent with the language of Kunze, buying that insurance affects a complete waiver under 537.610 up to the limits of that insurance. Otherwise, is to give a windfall to the insurance company.
Is the decision about whether or not there was a violation of public policy, isn't that a legal decision that the court must make before instructing the jury?
But dealing with respect to the jury instruction?
Right.
Yeah. I don't disagree with that analysis, and I think that, and that's certainly how the Court of Appeals looked at it in analyzing the situation and concluded, of course, that the trial court's decision that these were submissible claims was appropriate. The evidence certainly supported that. And so the jury instruction requiring a finding of reasonable belief by Mr. Newsom was really superfluous under that analysis because it required the jury to find additional facts over and above what they really needed to find. I see, my time is up if the court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just have a couple of points I want to address. With respect to Section 537.610 and the remitter issue, the Kunze case was not asked to deal with the situation we have here, which is judgment that exceeds the statutory amount. And so I don't believe this court has, or really any of the appellate courts, have had an opportunity to truly address this factual situation where we're talking about a common law court. And obviously it's our position there was no insurance coverage for this because of the endorsement. But if you get past that, a situation where there is coverage for a common law tort and a judgment is entered in excess of that. I don't think that's been addressed. I think it should be. I've only been practicing for 17 years, but I've represented sovereign entities a lot. And this issue comes up all the time. When you're involved in a mediation, the plaintiff's counsel always take the position that you've waived sovereign immunity up to the amount of the policy. And that's just not what the plain language of the statute says. And the comeback is always, well, why did you buy $2 million worth of insurance if the statute only allows you to buy $300,000 and you can only be liable for $300,000? And the answer to that question, as it pertains to this particular case, is that this policy covers MHRA claims, and it also covers employees who don't have the benefit of the statutory cap. And so I think it makes a lot of sense for this court to enter or provide some direction with respect to that, and hopefully consistent with the plain language of the statute. As it pertains to just whether or not, well, as it pertains to the issue of whether or not this entire claim is barred by sovereign immunity, Mr. Smith talked about the 2010-2011 policy. I would direct the court to the transcript at page 629, because I think that provides a pretty good explanation for how Mr. Newsom was offered the retirement incentive plan. He was offered $20,000 by the school district, and the school district gave him a document. This was part of our retirement incentive program. This was all initiated by the school district, and Mr. Newsom at page 629 talks about that and corroborates that. And so our position is that cannot possibly be consistent with the definition of claim as it pertains to that part of the definition, which defines it as a written demand for monetary relief.
What about the argument that the filing of the EEOC claim was a claim under the policy?
Well,
both of the policies.
Yeah. The language used in the claim about when a claim would be, I'm sorry, the definition of claim in the policy about when coverage would be triggered is tied to a notice of charge of discrimination, not a charge of discrimination. That's our argument.
Is that more a semantic argument? It says in a civil, criminal, administrative, or regulatory proceeding for monetary, non-monetary, or injunctive relief that's commenced by receipt or filing of a notice of charges. And you're saying it should have to say receipt or filing of charges?
Yes, I am. And I would direct the court to Grissom, the First National Insurance Agency, 371 Southwest 3rd, 869, because I think that case provides some pretty good direction about that issue. And the reason why it's more than just a semantical issue is because this is a claims-made policy.
Go ahead and finish your sentence.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, because it's a claims-made policy, coverage is triggered based upon notice.
And I understand that argument, but the wording is weird. If it said receipt of notice of charges or receipt of charge, but it says receipt or filing. So it's not basing it on notice to you. It's on filing of a notice of charges, which is odd. I agree with claims made policy, but that's the wording that's used. It says filing of a notice of charges, not received by you alone of a notice of charges.
I'm sorry to interrupt. No, I have two responses to that. Mm-hmm. One, if you look at the legal file at 440, there is a document that's entitled Notice of Charge of Discrimination, and it has a date, November 18, 2011. This is separate and distinct from the charge itself.
So you're saying within, if we look at the EEOC regulatory procedures, the claimant files a charge and then the employer gets a notice of charges.
Exactly. That's how it works. And if you look at that same definition of claim that I've been talking about, a claim is also a civil proceeding for monetary relief, which is commenced by, if I'm remembering the language right, the service of a complaint or similar pleading. So within the context of a lawsuit, you don't have notice of a claim until you're served with the lawsuit. And so if you the reading that we're, you know, the plain language of the provision we're focusing on is consistent with the other provisions within that same definition of claim.
Was that notice filed in the EEOC proceeding?
If you go to the EEOC or the MCHR file, this document will be in there. This is an MCHR document. It's a separate document from the charge itself.
Prepared
and the Grissom case talks a little bit about that, talks about notice being notice of charge of discrimination inside some other cases that talk about
and that. It's prepared by the commission itself?
Yes.
Would you respond to your opponent's argument that the school district never approved the endorsement formally?
Yes, I will. And part of our argument would be what Judge Stith mentioned, which is, first of all, they have the burden of proving that there's a waiver of sovereign immunity. The exceptions to sovereign immunity, waivers of sovereign immunity, are to be strictly construed by this court. They have to demonstrate, one, that there is a policy in place that complies with 432.070. The evidence with respect to the policy itself is no different than the evidence with respect to the endorsement. There is no doubt that we put that endorsement on the policy. We acknowledge that we bought the policy, and we know that there was an endorsement on the policy. But they haven't proven that there is an absence of evidence at all with respect to the manner in which the endorsement was put on the policy, at least from the perspective of the board and the board's involvement, just like there's an absence of evidence with respect to the board whether the board approved the policy in the first place.
Any other questions?
Why doesn't your answer take that issue out of play?
Well, you
could have answered and said, you know, the board didn't approve, and then they'd have to approve possible. That's the part of that argument that I don't understand.
Yeah. In our answer, I'll have to go back and look at exactly what we admitted in our answer, but I'm confident that we would not have admitted in our answer that the board, that all of the requirements under 432.070 had been met with respect to the insurance policy. I'll stand before you right now.
And if the allegation is, you know, the school district has a policy number XYZ, and the answer is we admit, doesn't that assume that all that occurred or not?
I don't think it does, Judge. I think we just admit what the allegation was, and I don't believe that there was any allegations made in their petition that went through all of the steps that they now claim are necessary in order for there actually to have been an insurance policy in the first place or an endorsement to that policy. I'll tell you right now, I admit today we do have an insurance policy. We paid for it. We also have an endorsement to that policy that prevents us from waiving sovereign immunity. The evidence isn't in the record, Your Honor.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. Case will be submitted.